This week, we have a special guest, Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw. Right Worshipful Earnshaw is a past Grand Historian for the Grand Lodge of Japan, a past Master of the Lodge of Research for the Grand Lodge of Japan, and a past chairman of education. Brother Earnshaw takes us deep into alchemical symbolism represented in Freemasonry through the East. Freemasonry often claims that light comes from the East, but just how far? Could the origins of Freemasonry be from China? We'll talk to Brother Earnshaw about this hypothesis and the amazing evidence that points to it being the truth. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 519. As you heard in the top of the episode, we've got a great interview with Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw, who was just fantastic, and honestly, I cannot wait to have him back on the program to dive in even deeper. Before we jump into the interview, I want to take a moment to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the program. Without you, we cannot make this Masonic education span the world and get the information into the hands of all those who are interested in the Royal Art of Freemasonry. If you're interested in how you can help support this program, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, check out your options there. In addition, there are a number of items that we do sell in our shop that I wrap up right here at my home office and mail those out to you. So they are coming direct from me to you, and my appreciation in advance for any assistance you're able to provide. Over the next few weeks, we've got some great guests lined up on the podcast. Of course, this week, we've got Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw, who is also Illustrious Brother Earnshaw. He's a 33rd degree as well. But we've also got interviews lined up with Brother Greg Knott on a surprise topic that I'm really excited about, and you'll hear more about that as we get closer. I'm also hoping to line up an interview, and this would be with Brother Jordan Kelly, who is the Western Area Education Officer here in the state of Illinois, to talk a little bit more about Freemasonry and its local challenges, which also might be national. And we'll talk about that and solutions and ways to look at things and just have a general conversation about Freemasonry. And I'm excited about that one as well. Next week, I've got a little surprise for you at the end of the episode. I'll tell you a little bit about next week's episode. Will be pretty fun. But for now, let's get into this great interview with Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw. All right, everybody, we are back this week, and we've got a special guest on the program. I first learned of this brother after finding some of his websites and YouTube channels, and he is available on the Masonic Instruction website as well. But we are really excited to have Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw on all the way from Japan. So, brother, thank you so much for making some time for us.
My pleasure.
Now, for those of you who don't know, you know, we're recording this interview at 7 p.m. Central Time in the U.S., and it's like 9 a.m. or in the morning over in Japan, I think, for Right Worshipful Brother Earnshaw. So he is out of the Orient of Japan in Korea. He's a past Grand Historian, Grand Lodge of Japan, a past Master of the Research Lodge, Grand Lodge Japan. He's a past Chairman, Education Committee, Scottish Rite, Masonic author. He's done all kinds of amazing work with his YouTube channel, Spiritual Freemasonry, and he's got several books out as well. And Brother Chris, can I just have you give us a little bit of a overview of your Masonic career?
Well, I think you said everything needs to be said, but I've been a Mason for 38 years. It's in the family. I know my grandfather, but also perhaps my great-grandfather was also a Grand Lodge officer. So it's something that we take a lot of pride in my family. I came to Japan some 40 years ago, and I was introduced to a lodge in Kobe, an English under the Grand Lodge of England. Later, I moved to Tokyo, and I joined a lodge under the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, and then one under the Grand Lodge of Japan, and finally one under the Grand Lodge of Scotland. We have this interesting situation because the Grand Lodge of Japan was not established until 1957, and before that, many lodges had been established in Japan, particularly when Japan opened up after the restoration of the Meiji Meiji Emperor. And so when the Grand Lodge was established, all the other lodges were sort of in situ. And so we have a large variety of lodges and the opportunity to experience different types of ritual, which is very interesting as well.
Absolutely fascinating. I know in places all around the world where we have larger continents with smaller provinces and things, we see different jurisdictions pop up and we see different ritual being performed here and there. And it sounds like Japan at that point was very similar. Can I ask, did you join Freemasonry? It sounds like you joined just before you moved into Japan, or you joined
just after.
Just after
I moved here, yes.
Let me start off by asking you, you're quite prolific in your writings, and I think your videos are really outstanding because very oftentimes we don't necessarily have great Masonic content on videos on YouTube that seem to be both relevant and accurate and trustworthy. And furthermore, what I really like about it, you have an air of authority just in that you're actually in the lodge room talking about things in many of the videos, if not you know, 90% of them.
Yes.
And so I really enjoyed this. What got you started putting out videos on YouTube under your Spiritual Freemasonry
yes.
YouTube channel?
What got me started? Yes, I'm not quite sure. I just felt that I would like to reach a larger audience. I'm very much into education and Masonic education. I find that a lot of the brethren don't have time to read or research, but short videos are very easy to absorb. And most of my videos are about, I don't know, 8-10 minutes long. So I try and make them short and to the point. One thing I like to do is to question everything. I'm a lecturer and past professor at a university here in the School of Social Science. And so I look at Freemasonry from the point of social science. By social science, I mean what was happening in England at the time Freemasonry started, speculative Freemasonry, that is. What was the economic pressures? How did people receive salaries? Did they have salaries? Actually, in fact, they didn't have salaries. They were paid piecemeal. What was the political ramifications of England being a Protestant country surrounded by Catholic ones? You know, and how did that affect Freemasonry? And it did have an effect upon Freemasonry, and this is the sort of thing I look at.
You know, oftentimes is we have somebody on who's written books on history of Freemasonry and what and all of these kinds of topics. It is rare that we come across, we do have wonderful scholars within the fraternity. However, there is something I think a little bit more special when we have somebody as yourself who is both a historian and is actually in the work in real life, as it were. This is quite remarkable. I do appreciate that the videos, you have them at these great marks through, you know, the 7 to 10 minute consumption, so nobody's getting bored. you've written quite a bit on Freemasonry, and I understand your most recent book is Freemasonry Royal Arch, the Spiritual Freemasonry series, and it's part of a series of books that you've written about, it seems, alchemy, Freemasonry, and Chinese culture, is it?
Correct, yes.
What can you tell me about this?
Well, at university, I went to London University. I studied at the School of Oriental and African Studies, and I did Chinese and Japanese for a Bachelor of Arts. In hindsight, that was a really bad mistake. I thought that if you learned Chinese, then you probably understood Japanese. And in fact, it's two totally different languages, even though the written system is basically the same. So it felt like I was studying for two bachelor degrees. Big mistake. But I was very taken by Chinese philosophy and how the level of wisdom and how it was to the point. It wasn't kind of theoretical. They put it into stories taken from their own history to show where people in the past had made a mistake, and had they done something different, the outcome would have been much better. So and I was particularly interested in it, one of the Chinese philosophers called Mencius. He's a disciple of Confucius. And when there was a lecture about 4 years ago in Tokyo on Mencius, I went to it, and the speaker was a Chinese professor from Taiwan. He invited me to a Taoist temple in Taiwan, that was having an initiation. And that initiation only happens once a year in English, and they do it other times in Chinese. And I was really kind of, my interest was piqued. So I went to Taiwan, Taipei, and the initiation blew me away for several reasons. But one of the most important was that it was nearly exactly the same as the first degree initiation in Freemasonry. And I thought, how can it be? I mean, this is, there's so many points. I think I listed about 10 points that were exactly the same. So I came back to Tokyo. I used my very extensive university library, and I did a lot of research for about 3 years. And then it all started falling into place, all of the things I had looked at. It wasn't like a smorgasbord of research, but it just all clicked into one. I said, I have to write this down. And it became four books in the Spiritual Freemasonry series.
You had mentioned something, actually, that I find really interesting. And this is this idea that the Eastern philosophy, you mentioned it, how different it was than perhaps the Western philosophy. You know, in the Western philosophy, we have, of course, I think with many philosophies, we see an interweaving of our typical religious faiths and whatnot. So that notwithstanding, when we look at a lot of the Western philosophy, it's a lot of allegorical stories and types of thinking that aren't necessarily pinpoint and accurate. You know, when we think about something arguably, right, Neoplatonism, which has had an immense impact on the world, at least the Western world,
yep,
we end up with things like Platonic forms and these kinds of ideas. And Platonic forms, even when you speak to an expert on, let's say, Neoplatonism, you still don't walk away with a tangible, concrete idea about what perhaps a Platonic form is. You know, rather it's bucketed ideas and generalities. With the Eastern philosophy, it sounds like perhaps there's a little bit more direction there. Is that true?
Yeah, so it's rather like philosophy by allegory, if I could use that phrase. If I can give you a really short example.
Please.
I was working in the pharmaceutical industry at the time. I worked for a division of GSK, and I was sent to Japan by the head office. Only afterwards did I realize how the whole, what they call onboarding process, had been messed up. When I read Mencius, he was asked, so at the time of Mencius, the whole country was a collection of kingdoms. There wasn't an emperor at the time. So a king asked Mencius that if he was to send an ambassador to the neighboring country to try and make communications and the relationship a little bit better, what should he do? And Mencius said, you have to do three things. You have to, first of all, you have to send runners, people to go to the neighboring country and spread stories about how wonderful the ambassador is. And, you know, the country's number one diplomat is being sent as an ambassador, you know. So everybody's kind of anticipating this great man's arrival. Second thing you should do is the king should take the ambassador to the border of the country and say goodbye to him and make a big thing, show of it, so the neighboring country realizes how much country A, the first country, appreciates that ambassador's skill and hopes for the future. And the third thing you should do is not to confiscate or steal the ambassador's property while he is away. This was quite common in China because if you didn't have an army, you couldn't really protect yourself. So it often happened like that. In my case, what happened was I was sent to Japan. I had to buy my own airline ticket. I had to organize the hotels for me and my family, both en route and also in Kobe in Japan when I arrived. When I arrived there, then nobody knew I was coming. I got in a taxi, went to the office. Nobody knew I was coming. They said, you know, who are you? I said, well, you know, I've come here to run the marketing division. You know, they said, oh, I've never heard of you, you know. And while I was in England, I worried that if I was to go back from Japan to England, that I wouldn't have a position there. This is exactly what Mencius was talking about. So, you know, they would have got much more benefit from my working in Tokyo if the company had followed what Mencius had said which he said 2,500 years ago, he said this, and people still don't do it.
That's an excellent example, and it's very clear to see that even though it's allegorical, the lesson is absolutely there. You can,
yes.
You don't have to be a genius, right?
Yes.
Somebody should have been making contact and telling them that you're on your way and these kinds of things.
So, yes, exactly.
Very cool. When you started putting these books together, was it something that you actually had to split apart into different books, or have you been doing bits and then releasing and more and releasing?
Correct. I actually started with one large book because there was a certain flow to the contents, and I showed it to Lewis Masonic Publishing. They were very interested in it, but they said the book was too big. At that time, it was over nearly 600 pages long, and he suggested dividing it into smaller books. Well, that was another 6 months' work, because you all these cross-references from one chapter to another chapter had were suddenly in different books. And it was a lot of work. And in fact, they were correct. I think it's easier to appreciate when they're in smaller books. The books now, small books, are about A5 size. It's half of A4. And they're about 250 pages long. So they're much, much easier to read. And I've made the chapters very short because people are so busy nowadays. You know, if they can read a chapter that's 2 pages, that is easier to access than a chapter that's like 30 pages.
Isn't that
I've also received a contract to have the book done in Japanese. I've just completed translating it, and hopefully by the end of the year, it'll be published. And they went the other way. They said, no, we want the big book. We want the 600 pages. Let's see how that works out.
Isn't that interesting, like kind of the difference there between the Western and Eastern markets, a large tome versus, you know, smaller chunked out and smaller chapters and whatnot? And I can absolutely attest to the fact that, you know, you're reading an older book and, you know, we're usually around 10 to 15 pages in a chapter, looking in the 1990s and 80s even. And today, I mean, in one of Dan Brown's most recent books, his fiction books, he ends up with 100 chapters in a book because each chapter is 2 or 3 pages, which is interesting in and of itself. But
well, he likes the narrative to change very quickly from place A to place B, C, back to A, to keep the kind of speed reading through the book. When you're writing history, it is not speed is not of an essence. You want to get the details in and make sure that people understand the logic flow of the conversation. That's the difference.
Yeah, especially as you move through the text of a historical book, you are necessarily in almost a linear fashion. And when you do have to break away from a linear type explanation of event happening, the way you have to cut away to reference things has to be in just the right way for it to make sense and all of these things. So very much appreciate your work putting all of this together.
Thank you. I just really enjoyed it. I think it's an interesting contribution to the research of Freemasonry, I believe.
Absolutely, and you really don't hear much about it, to be quite honest. When I had first started my journey in Freemasonry, I was not so aware of Freemasonry in every single country. And when I found out that there was Freemasonry in Japan, let's say, I was absolutely fascinated by the idea, not for the typical reasons. I think that some people might wonder why or how Freemasonry got started in Japan, and maybe you can shed some light on this for us. And this is the idea that in the idea of quote-unquote regularity within Freemasonry, we have this kind of uncodified, unwritten rule that is official, that's not official, that regular Freemasonry consists of a few things. One of them is this idea of the Hieramic legend. There are groups of Masonic organizations in other countries that are not clandestine but are considered irregular, due to their replacement of the Hieramic legend with something like an Osirian legend or something along those lines. Given that the narrative, the allegory that we have within regular Freemasonry around the United States and certainly Scotland, England, and all of these places, we use this Hieramic legend, and it's really based around the Judeo-Christian schema of things. That particular religion, even though it's an allegory, it's still a based on a religious text, is it the same in Japan? And if so, how does that dynamic work?
Yes, so firstly, your previous question, how Freemasonry arrived in Japan, mainly through traders and trading companies who established warehouses in Nagasaki, which is in the south, and in Yokohama, which is very close to Tokyo. That's where the first lodges were set up. And over the years, they proliferated. We didn't have that many, but probably about eight. And then the Philippines set up their lodges after the Second World War. The conversation is exactly the same. We have the hieramic legend here, and there's no difference. We use the web ritual. The only difference is that we don't have a proper cipher per se, because if you write down in English light, in the cipher it'll be LGT or LGHT, leaving out the vowel. But with a Chinese character, you can't leave anything out. So the text is the full text. The only things are left out are the passwords, which people have to remember. But apart from that, everything else is there for somebody to read. I don't agree with that, but there's not much you can do about it. The Grand Lodge of China, which is based in Taipei, Taiwan, they have the same issue as well.
So would you say it's fair to say then that Freemasonry in China now, if we kind of flip the page a little bit and let's talk about Freemasonry in China, did Chinese Freemasonry also come about in this same way?
Yes.
Through ports and trading and whatnot?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so I belong to a lodge in Tokyo called Sinim, which comes from the Bible. I believe it's Hebrew for silk. And Sinim Lodge was originally, it's under the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts. Originally, it was in Shanghai. But during the war, Freemasons had to leave very quickly from China. They went to Taiwan and eventually ended up in Tokyo. So, yes, it was all through traders, and Shanghai is a big trading port, of course, and that's how it spread out.
With the practice of Freemasonry in Japan and China, would you say that there is major ritual differences?
Well, first of all, we can't say that Freemasonry is in China. The Grand Lodge of China is actually in Taiwan. There is no Freemasonry in China, the mainland. The only place we have Freemasonry now is in Hong Kong, Macau, and Taipei, and of course Japan. The ritual is exactly the same. The opening is different. Opening and closing are different, but basically it's the same. I think the Japanese brethren here take it probably a little bit more seriously than some other lodges. They dress in dark clothes and they do the ritual very precisely, and it's very good to see.
I'd like to switch gears now and talk to you a little bit about the connections between some of what you talk about in your YouTube channels and in your books regarding the symbolism in Freemasonry and and even some of the spirituality. Can you give me some beginning thoughts on some of this before we dive in?
Well, it's a deep subject. It's four books worth. But for example, the second degree, when we talk about the steps, 3, 5, 7, 9 or more, I believe these represent alchemical processes. So the three steps represents the tria prima, which are the three materials that are needed to do classical alchemy, basically sulfur and salt and mercury. And at one time it was magnesium, but that was changed because it's very dangerous. It was changed to salt. So that's the three steps. The next five steps are the five colors that these three materials change into. They change into, first they go into white and then black and then into red and yellow. And there's a fifth color called the cauda pavonis, which is the peacock's tail, which is like a rainbow multicolored stage. And the seven steps represents the seven processes that are necessary for combining these three materials. Basically, it's like heating and cooling and then separation and then calcination and the further other steps. But so this 3, 5, 7 represents the process of alchemy. And there's several other hints to it in the rituals. Another thing which I found was very interesting, which I talk about in the book, Initiation by Light. By the way, the Initiation by Light, when you look at all the other organizations around the world, including religious ones, but also Buddhist ones and philosophical ones, there are only two organizations that initiate with light, and that's Freemasonry and Taoism. And that's what bowled me over when I was in the initiation in Taipei. The man said, the priest, it was not actually a priest, he's more like an elder. He said, I will now bring the light from the east to the candidate. I thought, what? So it was a little bit of a surprise. But in the late Victorian times, in the 1890s, we had many diplomats, British diplomats based in China, particularly around the Shanghai, Wuhan area. And several of them wrote books saying that Freemasonry might have a Chinese origin, but they couldn't actually pin it down. One of them, his name is Chaloner Alabaster. He was the consul, British consul out there. He was later knighted. He wrote an article about Freemasonry and China. And he said, you know, it's nearly exactly the same. The two, very, very similar. The only thing is the Chinese don't have the story, the hieramic legend and the story of Solomon. So therefore, there can be no connection. But he also said, but on a spiritual level, we seem to be based on exactly the same teaching. And that is the truth, I believe. That spiritual level is the Taoist teaching that the Freemasons in 1717 built into the ritual. It's very, very subtle, but once you start to see it, it pops up all over the place in the ritual.
You know, what's interesting about the fact that you've just mentioned this idea of a Chinese origin and the idea that there's no Hiramic legend in the Chinese side of things,
yes,
that's not surprising at all. And in fact, is almost a negligible point because original Freemasonry didn't have a third degree until right. the mid-1720s, 1730s. So the fact, yeah, so this whole idea could have huge implications. Because just by removing the third degree out of it, which was an afterthought, it is perhaps the original, like, change,
extension?
Yeah, like the original extension to Freemasonry.
Yep. Yep.
Primarily what we've seen is a series of initiations that happened symbolically using various different degrees. And I think only later do we see the codification where everybody is trying to receive and give the same exact thing. Surely in this time, before the 1730s, you'll have variations that occur. And I really would not be surprised at all if the rituals and the general idea, the foundation stone, if you will, for what Freemasonry might stand for, could very well come from Taoism or Chinese philosophy.
Yes. So when we look at it in a social history context, Chinese things in England at the end of the 17th century, early 18th century, were very much in vogue. And this is something that other authors, I think, have overlooked, that we were importing Chinese tea, silk, furniture, chinaware, the cups were specially made in China with little handles on. The Chinese have the same cups, but they don't have the handles on. They don't hold it the same way. And so it started with all these sort of imports. And after a while, the aristocracy started to build into their houses Chinese features. So some of the rooms had Chinese wallpaper, Chinese furniture. Queen Anne, who was queen at the end of the 17th century, she was a great collector of Chinese chinaware. Sounds strange, but yeah. So she had cabinets full of this beautiful blue and white Ming Dynasty chinaware. And so what happened in England is that it's like now you have influencers and celebrities and everyone copies them. It was the same in those days, but everyone copied the aristocracy. And so if an aristocrat did something, then the hoi polloi, that's the general population, they tended to copy. They wanted to be, didn't want to be left out. And the number one influencer of the time, of course, was the king, or the prince regent in our case. And the prince regent was also a great fan of Chinese things. And we have drawings of him wearing Chinese clothes, you know, and Isaac Newton was wearing, is painted with a Chinese robe on. And so the Prince Regent, he changed parts of Buckingham Palace. So many of the rooms are in a Chinese style. He even built a pavilion for his relaxation in the south of England called the Royal Pavilion at Brighton. The outside is all Indian, but inside is all Chinese. With all sorts of interesting Chinese statues and all sorts of things. And so there was a real boom in Chinese things. And it didn't last just 2 or 3 years. It lasted about 60 years. And, you know, all the 60 years, all these Chinese things were coming in Chinese gardens. Even in London, we have a park, which is called the Royal Gardens at Kew. It's slightly to the southwest of the city. And we have a pagoda in the middle of the gardens, which was built in, I think it's 1726. And we had lots of other buildings. Unfortunately, most of them, because they're wood, they rotted and were destroyed. But the pagoda still stands, and it was recently refurbished. It looks really, really wonderful. So all these influences, it's not surprising that people would be interested in Chinese philosophy as well. Because of the movement, what was happening in the Royal Society at the time, and a lot of the intellectuals, books were being translated from Chinese by Jesuit priests. The Jesuits had a long history of being in China, and they built hundreds of churches, which they were all later destroyed for some internal stupid reasons. Anyway, so the Jesuits, being scholars, they translated these Chinese philosophy and famous books into Latin. And at that time, everybody read Latin. It's the kind of the lingua franca of Europe. So if you could communicate between France, Germany, and England by writing in Latin. And so a lot of people read this philosophy, and to them it was eye-opening, because it was just so fresh and unique and different. And many of them thought, well, were looking to see if they could actually incorporate Christianity and Chinese philosophy as a single unifying religion for the whole world. So rather than having Protestant Catholics fighting, they were looking to see what were the underlying teachings and if the Chinese could be incorporated some way. And so with all this interest in Chinese philosophy, three men would actually take the Chinese philosophy and put it on top of a structure of Freemasonry. Well, it wasn't Freemasonry per se, it was operative Masonry, and then recreate it in 1770 as something new. This explains why the aristocracy was so interested in it. Because from the beginning, I think it was the fourth year, fifth year, we had the first aristocratic Grand Master, the Duke of Montagu. And then after that, the calamitous Duke of Wharton, which we'd like to forget about him. But then after that, all the other aristocrats. And then 30, 40 years later, we had a royal grandmaster. And since then, we've had a lot of royal grandmasters. So what is it that would appeal to an aristocrat? You know, aristocrats have a classical educations, and they're not interested in meeting with laborers and workers, particularly not stone cutters. So, you know, what would attract them to join this organization? And I believe it was this new, unique Chinese way of looking at life. And not only that, Chinese Taoism has a unique spiritual experience built into it, where you can understand your immortality. And by not just talking about, you know, like in church in England, oh, we are immortal beings and we'll end up in heaven. No, the Chinese had a way you could actually experience it here and now without dying. And that would have been really interesting to the people of those times, I think.
Without a doubt.
I went on a bit, but
No, this is perfect context for the audience here, myself and everybody listening. What is fantastic, it's just something that I think you touched on here, is this idea of the in vogue of the time, the Chinese influence. It was fresh and new and exotic. And I know it's been talked about in Freemasonry in the last 5-10 years with people who talk about the Egyptian influence on Freemasonry.
Right.
Now, the idea here is I'm not saying the Freemasonry came from Egypt. I'm saying that certainly there may be elements of ritual and things that have been, you know, ritually appropriated through the thousands of years. However, we see the same kind of thing with Egyptomania, you know, stemming from 1799 to the 1830s and whatnot.
Exactly.
And so you start to see, for instance, in Detroit, Michigan, there's one of the largest Masonic halls in the world, if not the largest, and they have an Egyptian room, an Egyptian-themed room. And this kind of proliferates around America, at least. You know, we see these Egyptian rooms and things, and it speaks to the cultural fascination of the times where we can see correlations between things. But it seems like this Chinese influence on the aristocracy has come even beforehand.
Yes. So what one of the driving factors was that at the end of the Hanoverian period, before Queen Victoria became queen, England was selling opium to the Chinese, and it was growing. It had this triangular trade going on between India, China, and England. They would grow opium in India and then export it to China, sell it in China. They would receive silver ingots as well as tea and other valuable things to bring back to England to sell. The money was then put into growing more opium. It just went round and round in a circle. And then we had the new emperor came into China, and he would not stand for the Chinese people being taken advantage of like this, because it was just destroying his country. And we had then the opium wars, and then exports from China were suddenly, of course, stopped. And there was no more silk, tea, furniture, and all the other things that we got used to, and it just suddenly stopped. At the same time, as you mentioned, in 1799, Napoleon goes to Egypt, they find the Rosetta Stone. This wasn't translated until about 1822 by Jean-François Champignon. And once you had a translation, suddenly all these pictures in the Egyptian pyramids and temples, they suddenly make sense. You can actually read what's being said. And then you understand the interest in immortality. And a lot of people call Egypt a death cult. It's exactly the opposite. They believed that they lived forever. And they had this in their writings. And so they had this preoccupation about another world and living and continuing after, and the influence of spirits, how they influence the living. Well, this had happened exactly the same story had happened in England in the 1690s, when people started to question immortality. And they started by writing tracts, which are kind of like pamphlets. Later they became books, and they wrote books, for example, saying that the soul did not exist, that it was just a heathen invention, I think they called it. Well, this drew the attention of the church, and of course the church and parliament were virtually the same. And then these books and the authors got dragged into parliament. They had, instead of going to a regular court, they believed that blasphemy was so important that it involved the lawmakers. So the parliament got involved, and they said people who are writing books about immortality should be imprisoned and fined, and all their books were burnt by the public executioner, which is interesting because, as we see many things, like prostitution, the more you try to suppress it, it's like mushrooms. They pop up all over the place. So they tried to suppress these books on questioning immortality, and they just sold more and more books. They were published in Amsterdam and then smuggled back into England. So immortality, as we see in the ritual, is central to Freemasonry, particularly in the third degree. It's mentioned so many times, like 8 times. You will never, never die. The soul never dies, hoping for a glorious immortality. All these phrases that we use. It's because of that was going on in the public. The people thought, perhaps the soul does die, perhaps it doesn't. And then this Chinese teaching comes along and says, we have an exercise that you can do safely at home that will show you that you are an immortal being. And that completely countered this kind of questioning of immortality. And because it was written as a secret, and it's kind of like a puzzle using what we call steganography, which is a type of cryptography. People got really excited, and the people that got excited were the intelligentsia, the aristocracy, and that's what brought the aristocracy to meet Masons in a room above a pub. You know, they wouldn't normally do that. It's kind of, a pub is not really a place for the aristocrats, but you know, the Duke. But now the Dukes were happy to go to a rental room in above a pub in downtown London, not a very salubrious place, particularly where the Apple Tree pub was, Apple Tree Tavern. The Horn Tavern was in another part, in an exclusive part of London. It's also important to look at where these lodges were based in London, because part of London at the time was actually two cities, the city of Westminster, where the aristocracy lived, and then the city of London, which was the trading commercial area with the ports and the warehouses and things like that. Three of the original lodges were actually in this kind of commercial area, and one of them was next to the Houses of Parliament, where the aristocrats were. And so this made access for the aristocrats much easier, you know. Also, transport at the time was by carriage. There's about a five-mile difference between the two cities. Now, of course, it's all been built up, and you can't see the difference between the two. It just looks like one big city. But in their time, there was actually demarcation with parks and trees and country lanes between the two cities. And so this also is important, because the aristocracy had access to the Horn Tavern. And that's where all this new planning of the new degrees and rewriting the old operative degrees and adding in 1725 the third degree. And it must have been very, very interesting intellectually at that time.
This is so fascinating to me, because it's a fresh look at things that perhaps haven't been discussed as much as, of course, a lot of the Western ideas about Freemasonry and its origins. Mm-hmm. I want to pick your brain a little bit more on this idea, sure, in particular about spiritualism and Freemasonry. This fascination that people have with the idea of immortality, it probably has its largest Western boom with the rise of what we would call spiritualism in America as a full-blown religion, you know, with mediums and the like of all of these things. And along with these the ideas of charlatans and tarot readers and cartomancy and all of these things.
Yeah.
But we see even in Freemasonry the influx and outflux of creation of new organizations like Theosophy and the spreading of these kinds of things, grabbing Eastern ideals and then anglicizing them and almost selling them back to the Eastern people in India. Yes. and all of these. And one of the things that's so fascinating to me is our preoccupation with the idea of the eternal being. And so as a man and a Mason, we think somehow we just know, we believe this. We have a great faith in it, or we have a knowledge in it, whether you are, you know, through your religion, or maybe you're like me and you just equate eternity with the laws of thermodynamics, whatever the case may be.
With
these Chinese philosophies, though,
right,
having something that somebody can actually do to experience something had to be of such weight and arguably of like a coveted nature would necessarily permeate throughout the people or the populace who had this as a practice. And at least maybe in the Western aristocracy, were these like very guarded secrets, or?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, I think so. Other things that were going on at the time that we have to understand is that there had been a challenge in England because of the religious situation. And so, as I mentioned earlier, we were a Protestant country surrounded by Catholicism, Scotland, Ireland, Spain, and France. And we had a Jesuits in England, even though Catholics were no longer allowed to hold jobs or to practice their religion. Their churches were converted to Church of England. But we still were threatened with Jacobites, supporter of King James I and King James II, and the Charles, of course. So the Stuarts wanted to regain their throne from the Hanoverian Georges. And so there have been several insurrections, like January the 6th. We had similar things happening in England, but with armies. But luckily, the English army tended to be better trained and better organized, and we were able to hold them off. But if you look in the Constitution of Freemasonry for 1723, one of the first things that James Anderson writes is, you know, after the revolution or insurrection of 1716, he mentions it. But that wasn't the last one. There were other ones. There's another one in 1745. And so therefore, this is the part of the secrecy part that we needed to keep people who were non-believers and could be threats, terrorists, we may call them nowadays, from entering a lodge. And that was one of the reasons for the security, having a tiler with a drawn sword. And it accounts also for the blindfold, that once a person was led into the lodge, until he's made his obligation, he wasn't able to see. Well, what he wasn't able to see is one couldn't see who all the other brethren were, because then he may be able to identify them at a later date. So it was a very difficult time for Freemasonry, and I think this is why we should really respect the early brethren, John de Sagavilla, George Payne, and Anthony Sayer, of course, as well as James Anderson, for this work that they did to preserve the teachings and but write them in a type of steganography, is what I refer to. Steganography is a cipher where inside an image or a symbol or something, there is a secondary teaching that is kind of hidden. And this is what I look for when I research the degrees. And so this idea of secrecy, well, it appealed to the aristocracy, of course. I mean, everyone wants to join a secret club that nobody else joins. But it's also that they didn't want the teachings to be debased, or I think they wanted to keep them, secret as much as possible. It just came to mind. I just written a paper. I have on Anchor FM. I have a podcast where, because of Corona problems, I wasn't able to use the lodge to make videos, so I've been making podcasts instead. I wrote one recently about Freemasonry being a peculiar system of morality. Well, we hear that so often, we don't really challenge it, but what do they mean by peculiar? You know, if you look in the dictionary, peculiar means either unique to something or somebody. So this is a uniform that's peculiar to the Royal Marines or something. But it also means eccentric or strange or something. Well, when we look at the morality taught in the in Freemasonry, the virtues, the cardinal four cardinal virtues and the three theological virtues, these are Catholic ideas. There's nothing peculiar about them at all. They're not unique to Freemasonry, and they're not eccentric. This is what, you know, is based on Catholicism, and Church of England also uses the same theological and cardinal virtues. So what do they mean by peculiar? Well, I believe that's what it was a kind of signpost to Taoism. That is peculiar to Freemasonry, and not eccentric, but really rather odd by British standards. So we have to really deconstruct these degrees and look at everything, because our education now is different from those from that of those days. They had a classical education. They all spoke Latin. The intelligentsia and the aristocracy all spoke Latin. Many of them studied Hebrew because they wanted to understand the Bible in its original language, not translations. And people like Newton had pointed out that King James had changed some of the meanings in the Bible to fit his own theology, which wasn't the original. If you look on the internet, you can see that the King James Bible has some extra words added to promote an agenda, so to speak. And so they spoke Latin, so they would probably understand Italian, and of course they would speak French. Nobody does nowadays. And so when we look at our ritual, we have to think with a slightly different way of looking at it, because it was understanding that they had in that time.
I have to echo that, just in the fact that the context of the ritual, looking at the people consistently today, they try to push this narrative of either updating the ritual verbiage to something or to teach what they think it means. And that's fine. I have no problem with doing this as a secondary thing to learning the way it is. However, something that is very much that has to be maintained is the original historical context of the words and what they meant in the time it was written. And so, for instance, in Freemasonry, we have a lot of things that are very archaic in nature in the ritual. Yes. And when people hear those things today, for instance, you know, we use the word condescend, condescending. Ooh. And today we think condescending is a very negative thing. And in the context that it's written, it's more about stepping up or stepping down to meet your fellows on the level. Mm-hmm. So there's all of these different contextual meanings with history and whatnot.
Exactly. But, one of the first things that I spotted, I mean, I knew this when I first became a Master Mason because I had a semi-classical education. I studied Latin at primary school in England, and that was the kind of basis of our education, Latin. Some schools taught Greek. And so in the ritual, when it says Pythagoras exclaimed Eureka, and then he offered a hectum of cattle. These two things are strange. First of all, it wasn't Pythagoras that said Eureka, it's Archimedes. Now, any child in England would know that because that's a famous story about Archimedes getting into a bath of water and the water overflowing. And it showed him a way of measuring the amount of gold in an irregular object. Crown or something like that. And secondly, the hectum of cattle. Well, Pythagoras was a vegetarian. I think he probably wouldn't offer a hectum of cattle because, but anyway, there's a small point. But once you think, why did they write that? Because in the 1700s, they would have known it was Archimedes that said Eureka. So why is there such a blatant mistake in the ritual? And why hasn't somebody corrected it? Well, this is a kind of steganographic technique of showing you hints and things like that. Also, in one of the talks, it talks about a man not returning from the country from whose born no traveler ever returns. So it's talking about death and the traveler never returns. Well, actually, this is taken from Hamlet, this quotation. And of course, they would have known that Hamlet, Shakespeare had only died 100 years before. And in the theatre in London, that's probably 50% of all the plays being held were Shakespeare. There was so little other. So they would have known that land from whose born no traveler ever returns. They would know that. And so now that's another hint. And they're starting to think, 357 stairs, that could refer to this. And then he's talking about immortality and never returning. And then there's this hint to Archimedes and Pythagoras and Eureka. Suddenly all these hints start to make them think about something else, and that's what happened to me.
This has just been an amazing review. Right, Worshipful Christopher, this has been just an eye-opening interview and really a fresh look, exposing not only myself, but to all of our listeners, a fascinating new way to look at something. And I will, of course, we will have links to your books in our show notes for this particular episode. I'll also put the links on our website so that people can find them. And you have a podcast, which I believe is called Freemasonry in 7 Minutes or Less.
Correct. Yes. Yes.
Wonderful. And we've also got your website, which we will put a link up to also. For anybody out there, if you're just listening and you don't have time to go check the show notes, it's Chris-Earnshaw, EARNSHAW.com, and he's on Twitter, Author Earnshaw. We have his YouTube links, some PR on his books, and Facebook and everything else.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This, again, such a fresh and interesting look, and you are, of course, welcome to come back on the program whenever you would like.
Thank you.
I'm going to...
If possible, in the future, I have about 50 pictures that show what I'm talking about in detail. Pictures show so much more than words do, and I can show this whole progression of the Chinese and the Freemasonry, the marriage of the two, in a future, perhaps on YouTube or something for you. I'd be happy to do that.
Absolutely, and we'll set that up. Maybe here we can get it going within the next couple of weeks or even next month. We'll have something, if I can get something that aligns with your schedule. Right, Worshipful, thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you, Brother Johnson. I really enjoyed it.
All right. My thanks again once more to Right Worshipful Brother Christopher Earnshaw for his time and expertise. It's pretty rare that we have somebody involved in the historical
and research side of Freemasonry who is actually academically trained in it and does this for a living in a sense. So again, I will have links to all of Brother Christopher's books, his podcast, video channels, everything will be in the show notes so that you can find out everything you can to really consume this. So I hope you really enjoyed. Again, head on over to chris-earnshaw.com to see everything that Brother Chris has been putting his time into. And again, he was just a delight and an absolute pleasure to have on the show. If you'd like to have Chris do a talk for your lodge, whether it's Zoom or something else, really consider this because he does a series of talks. He's got a history of the revival of Freemasonry, Chinese Freemasonry, Freemasonry in the Kabbalah, spiritual alchemy in Freemasonry, a number of different lectures, and you can contact him directly by heading to masoniconstruction.com/Christopher-Earnshaw. I have a link to his Masonic Speakers Association page in the show notes. Also, you can book him just by contacting him direct. And I'm sure the time difference is a little weird. He is going to be in the future for most of us here in the United States at 7 p.m. U.S. time and Central. It'll be 9 a.m. his time the next day. So you'll be getting him bright and early if you schedule him for something for your lodge after 7 p.m. Central. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining us. Oh, and I think I promised you a surprise about next week's episode. That's right. Next week's episode is going to be called Let's Go Tarot. And we're going to read a couple articles and we're going to start a new segment where once a week we'll be pulling a card for contemplation. It's going to be pretty fun. I think you guys will all enjoy. You don't have to be crazy deep in tarot. We'll pull the card, talk about what it means, and then we'll reflect on what that could mean in our own individual lives. Help a little bit in our meditative practices, and maybe give us something to think about when we turn the radio off in our cars and reflect on our lives. Making good men better, right? So that's what we'll be doing next week. I hope you all will join us. It's going to be a fun episode, but that's it for this week. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.